Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, what does the Iran nuclear deal mean for the Iranian president?
The Supreme Leader supports Rouhani so far for one simple reason. The economy needed to get out from under the sanctions.
We hear about several new developments concerning the Greek bailout. We meet another migrant to the United States who seems to have found happiness. And we speak with a scientist working on the Pluto photo project. It's all ahead coming up on The Voice of America. The multi-front effort to sell the international agreement on Iran's nuclear program to U.S. lawmakers and skeptical allies continues today. President Obama, in a White House news conference Wednesday, gave a staunch defense of the deal as the best way to keep Iran from having a nuclear weapon. My colleague Jeffrey Young joins me now in the studio. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome.
Hi, Susan. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Fine, and you?
I'm fine.
Good, good. Say, you anchored the news conference. Was the questioning of the president harsh?
Not harsh, but it was critical at times. Several people asked questions that one would expect Israel to ask. Israel has been strongly against the pact, especially Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And on Capitol Hill, a number of lawmakers, especially those involved in next year's presidential election cycle, came out squarely against the agreement, saying that it gave Iran everything and didn't ultimately prevent Iran from getting a bomb 10 years from now. They wanted the agreement to stop Iran's nuclear program in its tracks. But as the president pointed out in his news conference, Iran, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, has the right to use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. He also said, in regards to Congress, "My hope is that everyone in Congress evaluates this agreement based on the facts, not based on posturing or politics."
Well, looking overseas, what does the pact mean for Iran's president?
Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, won his election to that office by pledging that he would do what had to be done to lift the sanctions imposed on his nation. This nuclear agreement, if Iran follows its terms, will indeed lift the sanctions over time. I spoke with Middle East Institute senior fellow Alex Fatanka about what political capital Rouhani gained at home by forging this deal.
Rouhani has two challenges. How to keep the supreme leader pretty much on board. And so far, on this one key issue, the nuclear agreement and getting the sanctions lifted and thereby improving the economy, the supreme leader has pretty much fully backed him in his last 2 years. That's been key. Without it, he couldn't be where he is today. So he wants to pretty much keep Khamenei on board whenever he does something. That is Rouhani's demand. It's very different from his predecessor, Ahmadinejad, who was more than happy to sort of challenge the supreme leader openly. Or even Mohammad Khatami, going back to that reformist presidency, he also confronted the supreme leader openly. Not so with Rouhani. Rouhani wants to have the supreme leader in the driver's seat. And if any reform is going to be enacted, he'd rather have the supreme leader okay from the top than sort of trying to force it on the leader. That has worked on the nuclear issue. The question then is, because there's another audience in Iran that voted for Rouhani back in 2013, and they want to see reform and change beyond the nuclear issue. They want to see political reform, political liberalization. They want to see some of those opposition leaders like Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi freed. They want to see some of those American prisoners, dual nationals freed. They want a different political face for the Islamic Republic. And that is going to be the biggest challenge of Rouhani. The question is, will he go with it? Will he even try this? If he does, then the question is, how much pushback can he or will he receive from the Supreme Leader's office? Because the Supreme Leader supports Rouhani so far for one simple reason. The economy needed to get under the sanctions. They're getting to a point where they might achieve that. But political liberalization is an entirely different animal. And I think, you know, depending on how Rouhani plays it, this could be when the serious tension between the presidential palace and the Supreme Leader's office can be expected.
That was Middle East Institute senior fellow Alex Vatanka.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
Michael Lippin is here in the studio with a social media update on the Iran nuclear deal. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, we were just hearing about the relationship between Iran's president and supreme leader. What have they been saying about the deal today, social and media-wise?
Okay, well, Iranian President Rouhani actually broke some news on his Twitter account in the past few hours. His handle is @HassanRouhani, and here's what he said. In a phone call just now, British Prime Minister David Cameron welcomed the Iran deal and Iran's constructive role in the negotiations. And the Iranian president followed that up by saying that both he and Mr. Cameron expressed interest in reopening embassies in each other's capitals and also in expanding ties in the framework of mutual interest and respect and combating terrorism in the region. Now, there was no immediate comment on that phone call from the British leader's office, but a Washington-based Iranian-born reporter for the Interpress Service tweeted some additional information about the embassy issue. Jasmine Ramsey, whose handle is @JasmineRamsey, reported that Britain hopes to reopen its embassy in Tehran before Christmas this year, and that would mean by late December.
What's the latest from the Twitter account of the Supreme Leader?
So Ayatollah Khamenei's English Twitter account last tweeted on Wednesday night Iran time, and it posted an English translation of his reply to a letter sent to him by the president announcing the nuclear deal. Now, here's what the Supreme Leader's message said. I extend my intimate gratitude for the constant and tireless efforts of your negotiating team for bringing the talks to a conclusion. But then here's the interesting part. Ayatollah Khamenei also wrote that the prepared text of the deal needs what he called careful scrutiny and must be directed through a defined legal process. So that's an indication that just like here in the U.S., Iran's legislative bodies also have to scrutinize the deal before it can take effect. And we know that Iran has conservative political elements who don't like doing deals with the West. And then there was this last note of warning in the Ayatollah's letter on Twitter, telling the president that you are well aware that some of the six world powers that negotiated with Iran are not trustworthy at all. So that just goes to show that even with this agreement, establishing trust between Iran and the West is going to be pretty tough. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. That's very interesting. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Countless scientific studies have been warning of a much warmer planet in the coming years. But now a British scientist recently presented evidence of the contrary that suggests Earth may be heading into another mini ice age within the next 15 years. A team led by Professor Valentina Zarkova from the UK's Northumbria University has developed a new model of the sun's solar cycle, a roughly 11-year period over which the sun's activity increases and then decreases. The team's model predicted that the amount of the sun's activity will actually drop by 60% during solar cycle 26 that takes place in the decade between 2030 and 2040. The last time the sun's activity was so low took place during the Little Ice Age that lasted from about 1300 to 1870. During the Little Ice Age, Europe and North America experienced much colder winters than today. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
European finance ministers held a conference call today to discuss options for a Greek bailout after Greek lawmakers approved a package of tough reforms early this morning. The yes vote on reforms was demanded by Greece's creditors in exchange for more bailout funds. Athens faces a Monday deadline to repay $4.6 billion to the European Central Bank. VOA's Ken Brademeyer is closely following the story, and he joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Susan. This is probably a good day for Greece. They've had a lot of tough days in recent weeks as they fall further into debt. But a couple things happened today that probably give them a financial lifeline.
And what's that?
Well, for one thing, the Eurozone finance chiefs agreed to hand Athens a short-term loan to meet its immediate debts, including taking care of that $4.6 billion debt it owes the European Central Bank on Monday. So that's the immediate thing. Probably more important in the long run is that the finance ministers also agreed to open talks on a new three-year, $94 billion bailout for Athens. That would be Greece's third in 5 years. But if they didn't get that, and if they don't get it eventually, Greece financially could collapse. And so that's good news. And one other thing happened today. The European Central Bank agreed to increase its emergency funding by nearly $1 billion for the Greek banks, and that may allow them to reopen fairly soon.
Say, I hear, though, there has been some violent protests, but also some peaceful protests in Greece about the bailout.
That all occurred last night, Wednesday night, as the parliament got ready to vote. More austerity in Greece is not popular with a lot of people, although polls show that 70% said that the country had to come to grips with, if it was going to stay in the Eurozone, it was going to have to agree to more austerity. And that's ultimately what happened in Parliament. But yes, there were clashes outside, peaceful protests, and then police had to contend with protesters throwing Molotov cocktails and the like. But in the end, the Greek parliament went ahead and approved the austerity.
So the demonstrations didn't lead to anything, but I guess let people be more relieved personally.
They certainly, it's not unheard of in Greece, and there's hardly wide acceptance or praise for the deal. After all, Syriza and Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras took office on a campaign to eliminate the austerity that the lenders had imposed on Greece. So he has had to back down, and that's what happened.
Well, thank you very much, Ken, for stopping by the studio and chatting with us.
Good to be here.
Coming up on International Edition, we have the next installment of our U.S. immigration series and speak with a scientist, a part of space history. We're going to eavesdrop on International Edition's Adam Phillips again in a conversation with a new American who has made a life for himself here in the U.S. Adam joins us on the line. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Susan.
So, Adam, tell us more about this person.
Well, the person that we're going to meet today, his name is Gurhan Orhan. He's a Turkish master jeweler and designer whose work can be purchased for a lot of money in over 200 American luxury outlets. I first saw his work when I happened to be walking past his store in his studio right here in New York near the VOA offices. His designs are gorgeous, non-blingy, which is my taste, and often hammered from pure gold using this rare technique that he gleaned from Ottoman documents back in his native Istanbul. Gurhan first came to New York in 1997 with his Australian-born immigrant wife, Fiona, who handles the corporate side of his business. That's why Gurhan says that coming to America was both a business and a heart decision. I spoke with him at his workshop, which adjoins his retail space, and asked him what was really tough about becoming a new American.
The most important challenge was that you cannot handle the language in the way you want to. And Fiona is Australian, and she's one of the sharpest English speakers, so we complete each other, I should say. Heart side is always keeping things intact.
Culturally, what is it that might be different here for you as a business person? I mean, I noticed that you gave me a cup of coffee, which is a very Turkish thing to do as soon as I walked in. Is there something about the culture of New York commerce and the competition of all that that you needed to learn that you can't read in a book?
No. Business is business all over the world. If they are not offering you coffee in a New York store, it's their loss, in my opinion. Money becomes more important than many things.
But you do serve coffee here. Tell me a little bit about what that hospitality is, the idea of coffee and welcoming the guests.
We have a saying, a cup of coffee gives you 40 years worth of friendship. If two persons are getting together for a bargain on something or maybe a kind of disagreement, they first put coffee because that gives them the friendship feeling. Then they start talking. But it needs to be Turkish coffee, first of all. I have a full set here. I can make you Turkish coffee next time.
Tell me a little bit about how you've integrated that that sensibility into your work here? I mean, I'd like to know what you bring to New York in that sense.
I tried hard to make it homey, not intimidating. And we become friends with our clients here. Mm-hmm. They come with their old jewelry to turn it into something that they may like to wear. And sometimes they come with their loose stones. We sit down, we plan, we draw, have fun. Now, for example, I have a ring to finish and I have a watch to finish. Alice will come soon for photo shoot. So it's not routine, and I love it. When you are making more than 40, 50 different styles each season, it may look like art to you, but even art needs to turn into money at one point. That's also a creative process. I love that part of the business too.
Would you have any advice for people who want to come over here or are here now? They want to come to America and pursue the American dream. What would you tell them?
I know the idea of American dream, and I believe that dream is your own dream. It doesn't matter where you are. Opportunities are everywhere. But this is the best city in the world. No complaints.
Thanks, Adam. Gurhan sounds like a real gem of a guy.
That he is. No free samples, though. Anyway, I'll talk with you next week, Susan. Thanks for talking to me.
You're tuned to VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? They're called rate-actuated straps, and they could dramatically decrease brain injuries, the kind American football players suffer. Eric Wetzel is with the U.S. Army Research Laboratory.
So we envision integrating these straps with the head system so that before the head strikes the ground, the straps will slow down that head motion, sort of like a shock absorber.
These straps are made with a viscous fluid that allows the straps to remain flexible at low velocity contact with the helmet, but they become far less elastic with higher velocity contact.
It's this elastic material that has this very special property that if you pull slowly on it, it's easy to stretch and it relaxes again, but if I jerk it quickly, it resists with much more force.
Once this technology is available to athletes, the trick is to get them to actually use it.
It also has to be comfortable to wear. You have to be able to put it on and off quickly, and frankly, it has to look cool.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
U.S. space agency NASA is releasing long-awaited photos from its New Horizons mission, and we're all excited about Pluto and what we're seeing on Pluto. Joining us on the line is Dr. Jorge Nunez. He's a planetary scientist with Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, and his specialty is lenses. And I want to welcome you, Doctor, to our program, and we really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us what the pictures look like?
There's a variety of pictures that have obviously been presented and released. And so one of them that has come back is a full image of Charon, which is just fantastic. So it's a very similar image to what we saw with Lori that was shown on Tuesday, revealed on Tuesday.
What are you saying? I guess the names I'm not familiar with.
Well, so Charon is one of the moons, and so it's the largest moon of Pluto. And so we basically, with this flyby, we turned a point of light into a full moon, and with Pluto, obviously, into a planet. And so what we're seeing is that these bodies are just incredibly complex and very different. And so with the view of Charon, we see that there's a dark spot right near the pole, and also that there's this big canyon almost 1,000 kilometers wide that runs right along near the near the middle of the equator. And so we see that it's also the surface is also very relatively young. The same thing with the highest resolution image that came down of Pluto.
How can you tell their age from looking at the surface?
So if you look at the image of the moon, you see that there's a lot of craters on the surface, and the same thing with Mars. And so we use, so what planetary scientists do is they obviously we can't date the rocks.
We can't date them yet, is what you mean.
Well, exactly. We can't date them yet. Exactly. Well, we do have some meteorites that have come back. We know now that we have meteorites from the surface of Mars as well as surface from the moon. And so we can date those rocks. But primarily, when we're exploring unexplored worlds, so for example, like with Pluto, what we use is we look at craters. And so we, by counting the number of craters, and especially the size of the craters, it tells us information about how old the surface is. And so the greater the number of craters you see on the surface, most likely the older the surface is. So what we're seeing with the surface of Pluto is that even though Pluto has been around probably since the formation of the solar system around 4.56 billion years ago, we're seeing that not many craters. And so what that tells us is that some activity is, geologic activity is resurfacing the surface of Pluto, thereby wiping away any potential, any remnants of any craters that we see. And so some of the estimates that were presented yesterday is that it could be as young as 100 million years ago.
It's all so exciting and interesting. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And good luck with your project.
All right, thank you very much.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
By the end of 2015, the Millennium Development Goals, or MDG, the United Nations' 15-year plan to cut global poverty by half, will run out of time. So the UN is drawing up the Sustainable Development Goals program, which is meant to succeed the MDGs and to consolidate their gains. Like its predecessor, the Sustainable Development Goals program identifies poverty as humanity's greatest challenge and sets its elimination in all its forms as top priority. Other goals include the promotion of people's well-being through better health, education, nutrition, empowerment, and gender equality, to name a few. All these goals, said Michelle Sisson, U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, can be more easily achieved by promoting Goal 16, the rule of law. That's because when a society adheres to the rule of law and citizens become better able to make their voices heard, society becomes more committed to living by the rule of law. But when the law is selectively applied or written in such a way as to disadvantage certain segments of society, everyone loses. For instance, most smallholder farmers are women. But in many countries, laws discriminate against women by not allowing them to inherit land, sign legal contracts, or access financial services, thus depriving them of access to needed equipment and better seeds. Changing these laws to provide women codified and equal rights to land tenure would increase food production. Studies have shown that securing and recognizing women's land rights can increase agricultural productivity and shared household decision-making, and thereby help lift families out of poverty, said Ambassador Sisson. Similarly, laws that protect civil society from oppression could help generate new ideas and encourage entrepreneurship. Laws promoting transparency would diminish corruption, improve economic activity, and restore citizens' faith in their leaders. And all such changes would support other key elements of the development agenda. The rule of law promotes respect for freedoms of expression and association, transparency, and facilitating access to justice, said Ambassador Sisson. With respect to each of these principles, freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, transparency and access to justice, the rule of law impels societies ever forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.